Spout Blog and the Webby-nominated Film Couch podcast are covering what's truly interesting in the film world every day. Find out why the New York Times says Spout Blog's got it all at blog.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Campanaro.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. This week, Sidney Lumet finally files that restraining order against Adam after he tries to list Peter Finch's turn in Network as his all-time favorite final performance.
That's right. We'll share our top five swan songs later in the show, plus your Dark Knight feedback, Massacre Theater, music by C. Ray, and the fourth film in our classic heist movies marathon, The Italian Job.
But first, the brain, the athlete, the princess, and the basket case. The whole gang is here in American Team.
Maddie, what do you need a fake ID for?
So I can vote.
I don't fit in. I hate it. Warsaw's such a conservative town, and I'm so not conservative.
Turn it up, man! Turn it up!
Most people around here just stay, you know, in Indiana. That doesn't sound great to me. I do what I want to do. I'm here to be me. I know it's wrong, but I just believe in getting even.
I don't have many friends, so it's always been really important for me to have a girlfriend. Hey, is Lauren here?
Yeah.
A few weeks ago, Maddie, during a listener feedback segment, we played a clip from Richard Linklater's classic high school movie, Dazed and Confused.
All right.
In the scene, a pensive Randall Pink Floyd tells his friends, "All I'm saying is that if I ever start referring to these as the best years of my life, remind me to kill myself." I think it's fair to suggest that no matter how good you had it or are having it in high school for our younger listeners, Pink is offering up a pretty choice mantra there to live by. Even for those lucky enough to be part of the in crowd or part of whatever crowd doesn't get taunted mercilessly by the in crowd, high school is a mostly miserable, anxiety-filled experience full of fear and loathing. I'd sign up to go back and repeat my 4 years as an undergrad in a heartbeat. Go through high school again? Sorry, Peggy Sue, you're on your own. That high school anxiety actually still even creeps up whenever I get a reunion invite in the mail. And I felt a twinge of it, I have to admit, walking into the theater at the Sarasota Film Festival in April to see Nanette Burstein's documentary following five kids as they navigate their way through their senior years at a small-town Indiana high school. Rightly or wrongly, American Teen is being packaged as a nonfiction update of The Breakfast Club. And the archetypes mostly apply. There's the basket case, or potential basket case, Hannah, the brain slash band geek, Jake, the jock, Colin, and the princess, Megan. Sadly, we don't really get the Judd Nelson criminal character. In his place is the preppy Mitch. So, Mr. Class President of St. Peter High School, Maddie Ballgame, you came from a small-town Midwest high school just like these kids. Could you relate to the seniors of Warsaw High? And did you enjoy American Teen beyond the fact that at least it wasn't you up on the screen getting rejected, dumped, cheated on, nagged at by parents, and missing the big shot?
Well, I could certainly relate to it. And there were a few moments in the film that are genuinely effective.
A few.
Heart-wrenching, heartwarming. Only being 6 years removed from high school, I forget how life and death high school stakes are.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, to watch these kids struggle, find out who they are, that's truly moving. But unfortunately, overall, this thing was far too overproduced and dumbed down that I felt completely disengaged. And it reminded me of Reality Bites. Ben Stiller is this MTV-like exec. He takes Winona Ryder's raw footage of her friends, and he slices and he dices it up, and he adds a crazy pizza graphic replacing the heads of Winona's friends as pepperonis. That's what director Nanette Burstein has done here. She added the pizza.
No.
They didn't trust their material.
No.
Oh, dude. All those graphics.
There
were so the superimposed text messages. You didn't need to do that.
They were not, Adam.
And the other thing that they did, they add all these silly sort of graphic cartoons. We don't need it.
But their
worst crime is the fact of the matter is they forced convenient, banal storylines on the audience. Have you ever seen The Hills on MTV?
No.
Basically, okay, it's four or five privileged young women that allow MTV to shoehorn Melrose Place sort of plot lines into their lives, which results basically a succession of scenes strung together of well-dressed young women engaged in absolutely vapid conversations, talking in absolutes. I can't invite Audrina to the party. Oh my God, Audrina's sitting over there. It's mind-numbing. How do I know it's mind-numbing? Because I TiVo it every week. American Teen is not as egregious as The Hills, not even in the same ballpark, but it commits the same sins. in the end, the producers here kept this movie from being what truly could have been a transcendent and insightful picture.
You're dead wrong here.
No, I'm not
wrong. This is a wonderful film. This is a wonderful documentary. The characters are amazing in it. And the only part I'll agree with you on is I do feel a little bit dubious sometimes about where Burstein's camera is, because she seems to be in the right place at the right time all the time. But you're dead wrong about the text messages. I mean, the camera's just there. There's no effect going on there.
Rather than just having the messages run across the bottom of the screen, I don't want to get hung up on this because it's a really slight thing, but they superimpose it on there and show, and yes, I'm sure that's what they actually said,
okay,
but they dumbed it down.
I don't know what you're talking about. No, actually, it's not. It's really effectively put together. I've actually seen it twice now, and I liked it even more, and I was moved by it even more the second time, and it is because of those characters. I think that Burstein, first of all, just like any good fiction filmmaker, she did an amazing job casting the kids that she did. Hannah is clearly her favorite. She opens and closes the movie. I figure she does get the most screen time. And being an artsy, aspiring filmmaker, it's probably a safe bet that there were parallels between Hannah and Burstein herself. So, of course, she's going to get a little bit special treatment.
No, you're absolutely right. And the fact of the matter is, Hannah Bailey is the best part of this
film. She is.
And I was so happy. I saw it at a screening with her, about five or six preteen girls sitting there watching this film. And I was so happy that they got to watch this wonderful role model. She really is. She's wonderfully talented. She's completely insecure. I was there with her. And you're right, at the beginning of the film, when it's Hannah Bailey's story and we suffer that love lost, and I know you actually haven't been there because you married your high school sweetheart, but it's,
no, I've never had my heart broken.
It's
right,
like
Maddie,
a shiv to the stomach, and you're right there. But unfortunately, what do they do? What do they tag on? She tags on this tacky Edward Gorey like cartoon so we can actually feel what she is. The fact of the matter is, we didn't need that. We didn't need the Burger King glass. Give us the gritty material. Let the cameras roll. Trust your audience.
Okay, I think she trusts her audience, and I think that Hannah, as you said, is easily the star of this film. I think that most viewers watching it would want to know in real life what she's like. They'd want to hang out with her. I think she's obviously the most likable person
here. There's no denying that.
She's actually a real-life Juno in a lot of ways, with a great wit, and she's got a wonderful sense of humor and that outsider's perspective, just without the Diablo Cody zingers, which is fine. And I don't want to spoil anything for people. You talked about the love loss, and that's fine, because she does go through a breakup there. That's not a big spoiler by any means. But I do want to be very vague about the fact that a really surprising love story develops with her and another, obviously, senior in this story. And that first flourish of love, of that relationship, it's not love, but the first flourishes of that relationship are among my favorite scenes, Maddie, of any movie this year. It's a great love story.
I can enjoy this movie on a meta level, because the fact of the matter is that guy, that guy wasn't even meant to be a part of the film. But then he realized, hey, there's cameras around Hannah Bailey all the time.
No.
I'm totally,
you're
I can date that girl. No, I'm not at all. You go back and you watch.
Cynical.
He's not even in the beginning. But why not? Who wouldn't do it? Who wouldn't do that?
The character we're speaking of, which again I don't want to give away, is a wonderful character and really provides some of the best insights in the film to see a character break the stereotype and not be the kind of person you think he is. I think you're reading in a lot there, which is fine. You might be right. I just think you're reading in a lot.
Dude,
but
who wouldn't do that? I applaud
I don't know.
He sees these cameras. He knows how Hannah Bailey is.
No, that never even occurred to me.
It's because you drank the Kool-Aid with this thing.
Maybe so. But you root for Colin, the basketball player here. You root for Mitch. He's a level-headed, nice kid. You root for poor Jake, who wants a date so bad.
You root for Colin. You root for Colin,
of course,
because
he's a nice kid.
Oh, or because he's going to go into the Army. If it's not a basketball scholarship, it's going to go into
the
Army.
Those scenes with his father
were wonderful, Maddie. Did you notice at the dinner table how his hand, the father's hand, is covering his mouth because they're looping over a voiceover?
No.
Basically, what she's doing is it's completely true.
No, okay.
It's completely true.
No.
I want you to go back and watch it now.
I've seen it twice. There's no looping. There's no hands. There's no trickery,
yes,
Maddie.
There's completely.
His
she
father
is forcing storylines.
No,
he's not.
His father
you know
is
that.
Saying
he's a
that.
Wonderful, lovable teddy bear of a man who's an Elvis impersonator. He's not going to send his kid.
Actually, incredibly annoying as a father, and he puts a lot of undue pressure on his son, which is one of the things I really like about the movie.
I see you lapped this thing up.
I did. I totally lapped it up. And
you're a smart guy.
Oh, and suggesting that I liked it makes me a dumb guy.
No, you're a smart guy, Maddie. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying you're a smart guy. You didn't feel yourself being manipulated here.
No, I did, because there are times, including at the very beginning of the film, where at first I was like, okay, I don't like where she's going, because it opens on Hannah, and it's the shot of her in her bedroom, and it's clearly staged, and there's a voiceover, and the voiceover is clearly scripted.
Yes.
And immediately I was like, great, we're in real world territory here. This movie's going to be everything I didn't want it to be. But you know what? After that point, I didn't see a lot of that. And I think the birth scene lets these characters be more than just the roles we expect them to be. I even found that the character Megan, who is the princess of the film, she's going to be one of my biggest villains of the year by far at the end of the year. She's going to be number one on the list. But
because
you know what?
She's so unguarded.
Well, maybe so. By the end of the movie, I mean, I even found my hatred for her waning a bit, just a little bit, as she seemed to mature a little bit as the movie went on. And then she takes a backslide. But really, I just think that the movie actually subtly shows the impact that parents have on their kids. And Colin and Hannah and Megan, we see how these parents push them negatively, but they have the best intentions. And that's what I love about it, is no one is a villain in this movie except maybe Megan. I think she proves herself by the end of it. But the parents are just trying to do...
There's nothing subtle about it.
They're trying to
messages.
Do, Maddie, what is right. They are. And they're not being too abrasive or, you know, dictatorial. And actually, I watched it and I thought, you know what? This is a movie that I think should be required viewing for kids entering high school and for parents. It reminds us, it even reminds me now with younger children, how we can put pressures on our kids without maybe being aware of it. And, you know, American Teen, the title is bad. Anything with American in the title deserves to be ripped because you know the movie can't speak for some kind of, you know, universal American experience. But I think she comes as close. I think Bursting comes as close as you can get. These are universal experiences and lessons that all of us can deal with. Even the kids listening right now who are out in California, their life is nothing like these small town Indiana kids. They're going to watch these kids and recognize themselves in them.
Of course you will. You can't help that. There are moments of that once you dig underneath all the contrivances poured on top of here. I'm with you on Hannah Bailey. I loved Colin. But the band geek, are you kidding me? That guy realized that there were cameras around him. He can go up and talk to every single girl he ever wanted.
So?
Of course.
But Maddie, that's real too. That's just as real. The camera is capturing it. It's a documentary. It's
exactly,
real.
And you're exactly
it
right.
Them.
That's exactly right. That's the only level that I enjoy this movie on. I'm saying, hey, look at this
Fine.
Guy. Exactly. But he's not the label that she wants to put on.
What do you mean he's not? He's the biggest geek I've ever
no,
seen in
he's
my
not
life.
A, he's a smart kid. He's going to Lawrence. Again,
but he has
I
no idea who he is, and he doesn't know how to interact with women. And those scenes are excruciating, and those are real.
Yeah. All right. You're right.
They're
right.
Real.
There are some real moments in there because he wanders into a relationship because he has these cameras where he feels compelled that and powerful enough to go up and talk to these
you
women.
You don't think that kid goes up to every hot girl and asks her out because that's the kind of guy he is, like
no.
He wants so desperately? You think he's doing it just because of the camera?
Yep.
Well, even
Completely.
If he is, that doesn't
Completely.
Bother me, but I think you're wrong. I think that's who he is.
I just saw the cameras too much. I saw them too much at play here. I felt that I was just being pushed along.
Wow, I didn't feel that at all. And actually, I want to defend, because I know you're not alone here, I want to defend the fantasy sequences, the animated sequences. I know some people don't like them, but I really love them because they were these moments.
Tacky.
No,
they're
they
tacky.
Were these great moments, Maddie, dramatizing these characters' fantasies. These high school kids, their ideal visions of themselves. Their whole world is out in front of them, and we see in these little montages their ideal visions of what they think they could be. And it's interesting that Hannah is the only one who doesn't get a dream. She gets a nightmare. She gets this whole montage about her fear of turning into her mother and basically being crazy. And I'll tell you, I didn't like that at first because I didn't understand why she shouldn't get the same dream
Let
vision
me
that everyone
more
else.
Time. Let me spend more time with the mother and come to that realization myself. We only get two scenes with the mother at the end. We don't get enough scenes with her and her grandparents in that
little
interaction.
Bits, Maddie. They're not. She's not trying to hammer something, you know, you into submission. She's trying to show you a little wonderful visual flourish.
This whole movie is hammering things right down my
maw. No, I liked it. I ended up coming to terms with the Hannah one because in the end, I realized it kind of makes sense. She's actually the biggest dreamer in the film already. Her fantasy isn't something that's unattainable like some of these other people. She already sees herself as this future filmmaker. It wouldn't make sense, actually. That would be heavy-handed to dramatize what we already see in herself and what she sees in herself. I actually then, by the end, it made sense to me. I like those animated sequences. I mean, I don't think they're, you know, amazing cinema or the best thing about the movie, but they didn't bother me a bit.
No, unfortunately, I just don't think this movie adds much to the conversation at all. Outside of Hannah Bailey.
It moved me tremendously, and many more characters than just Hannah. And like I said, I think it should be required viewing. I fell for it. Hook, line, and sinker, Maddie. I'm sipping the Kool-Aid here. American Teen is out now in limited release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
All right, time for a quick break. When we come back, we ask the eternal question, is it better for a film to be consistently mediocre or take a nosedive from near brilliance two-thirds of the way in? Your feedback on The Dark Knight is next. Stay with us.
Here we have an artist's rendition, the vision, but it's clouded soon. Every time he walks in the room, wearing that monkey suit. Call me.
had Maddie, a friend and fellow film critic, Charlie Lyons in Percival, Virginia here. Just wanted to chime in on a few recent topics. First of all, loved your top five performances of the year so far. Heath Ledger, Naomi Watts, and Mila Kunis in their respective movies were all fantastic, as you guys like to say. On to your best films of the year so far. Anticipating your guys' list, and before listening to your show, I'd like to give you mine. Number five is Chop Shop, a wonderful little film I saw on the instant part of Netflix, Michael Haneke's Funny Games. Number three, Van Zandt's Paranoid Park. Number two, The Dark Knight. And number one, In Bruges. Love the show, guys. Keep up the great work. Bye.
Hey, Adam and Maddie. This is James from Las Vegas. Just a few thoughts on The Dark Knight. I saw the film before listening to your reviews and agreed with a lot of what you guys said. Two-Face kind of feeling a little tacked on. The last couple scenes not really working for you. I've seen it a few more times, and the Two-Face transformation actually works a lot better during the second viewing. Though what does not work the second time around is that final fight in the tower and the fairy sequence. The fight never makes any sense. You never have any sense of place. And the fairy scenes are actually worse when you know what's going to happen. I still plan on seeing it a ton more times. I really liked it, and I hope you guys get a chance to see it again. And I hope you like it a little bit more yourselves. Keep up the good work.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. We've cooled off a little bit. Hopefully you have, too. A couple of great voicemails there from Charlie and James. First of all, Charlie, a little Maddie Robinson disciple out there in Virginia.
I'm hoping Chaz actually comes on the show. It can be me and Chaz one of these
weeks. That'd be great. He can fill in for you right now, Maddie, as far as I'm concerned. But he had a great top five list there, echoing much of what was on your list, though obviously he liked The Dark Knight a lot more than you. And then we heard from James on The Dark Knight, and he said he saw it that second time. He thinks the Harvey Dent transformation works better, but the action scene at the end still doesn't work. Obviously, we would probably agree with that, and we are going to finally close the door on The Dark Knight here a little bit later in this segment as we get into some of your feedback. We wanted to share a couple of quick notes before we get into our poll questions. First of all, we have a survey that you can take that would really help us out. It's very quick, literally take you about a minute, maybe two tops, at filmspotting.net. You can find the icon in the right rail there at filmspotting.net, and actually a random survey filler outer is going to get an iPod Touch. We'll have a chance at winning an iPod Touch there. And also, we're very pleased to announce that we're going to have a Film Spotting meetup Saturday, August 23rd. In Chicago, maybe we'll relive the Battle of American Teen. We'll get up there on stage. We'll bust the mics out. It could be fun, Maddie.
You are rattled right now. You are so rattled. I'm so calm, dude. Calmer than you are.
Well, I'm glad. After that last segment, I'm glad you've calmed down.
Calmer than you are.
Well, we have that meetup, and you can find out more information about that as well. And RSVP, we look forward to seeing many of you there, hopefully. Again, August 23rd, and that link is at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, our poll questions. We'll share our results from last week first. We wanted to know what you thought the best movie of the year so far was. Here were your choices: The Dark Knight, In Bruges, Iron Man, WALL-E, or Other.
The Nolan brothers ran away with it. 57% The Dark Knight. I guess we shouldn't be too surprised by that. Second, WALL-E, 21%. In Bruges, 12%. I'm glad to see that.
Me.
I'm glad to see that. Other, 8%. And Iron Man, only 2%.
Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised that The Dark Knight and WALL-E finish 1-2, but Other, I thought, would either finish second or third, because that's encompassing every
right,
other
everything
film
else.
That came
yeah, and
out
it's
this
been
year.
A good year for
and
films.
It has been pretty decent so far, so I'm a little bit surprised that Other isn't higher, but In Bruges, your number one pick up there at 12%, but again, The Dark Knight running away with it as expected. This week's poll question, you can make your voice heard at filmspotting.net. We're asking you about David Gordon Green. Of course, his new movie coming out is The Pineapple Express. James Franco, Seth Rogen will be reviewing it here shortly on the show. So we're asking you what you think David Gordon Green's best film is.
Is it All the Real Girls, George Washington, Snow Angels, which came out this year, Undertow, Holding Out Hope for Pineapple Express, or Wish I Had an Opinion?
Where are you going right now in this poll question,
Maddie? I am holding out hope for Pineapple Express because I haven't seen Snow Angels.
Okay. Well, right now it's a tough one for me because I did really like Snow Angels. I would probably go with, I don't know, you know what? I actually like all those movies about the same. I really like George Washington and All the Real Girls and Snow Angels. Undertow is the only one I haven't seen. So if I had to vote, it would be one of those two, either George Washington or Snow Angels.
I've seen Undertow. I don't think you would include it up there with those.
No, and actually Candace mentioned that too when we were putting together this poll question, but I haven't seen it, wanted to include it. Of course, if you don't like David Gordon Green and you are interested in Pineapple Express, maybe you can go that way. Maybe you're a listener out there who's not familiar with his work. You can go with Wish I Had an Opinion. Again, you can make your voice heard at filmspotting.net.
Should we give in to this terrorist demands? Do we really think that he's going to...
rather protect an outlaw vigilante than the lives of citizens?
The Batman is an outlaw. But that's not why we're demanding he turn himself in. We're doing it because we're scared. We've been happy to let the Batman clean up our streets for us until now.
Things are worse than ever!
Yes, they are. But the night is darkest just before the dawn.
All right, a clip there from Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. And as we said, we are going to officially close out now our 3 weeks' worth of discussion on The Dark Knight. But we had to share your feedback. We shared a little bit last week.
We received an avalanche of responses here. So apologies if we didn't get to it, but I guarantee Adam and our interns did get a chance to read them all. Daniel Citron, formerly of Chicago, Illinois, currently residing in Santiago, Chile. Oh, I have to say, I left a girl in Santiago, Chile.
Did you?
I did. I would like to respond to one of Adam's comments on this week's podcast regarding The Dark Knight. You protested against the final scene, saying it was too chaotic and that it was impossible to tell where anything was. There was a time when I might have agreed with you. However, I think the chaotic style of that final fight scene works fairly well. If you were in Batman's place, something I try never to do, you wouldn't have any better idea of where everything was than the audience. Maybe the director failed to establish the space in that scene on purpose so as to make it as disorienting for the audience as for the characters involved. I especially like the way I jumped when the Joker, laughing, seemed to almost literally come out of nowhere. I think it was overstating it to say that the scene was reminiscent of Michael Bay, even though I lost track of where everything was. I never lost track of the plot or each of the characters' motivations.
Well, I think it's actually fair to say it's reminiscent of Michael Bay, which is what I said. Not totally Michael Bay, but a little too similar maybe. And I know what Daniel's going for, but the fact is there is a fine line between being completely disoriented and actually just trying to give that effect to the viewer. And I would give you an example. Ridley Scott's Black Hawk Down, Somalia, fighting in this urban situation here. It's mass hysteria, dogs and cats living together. I mean, it's total chaos. And yet he manages to find enough ways to work in aerial shots and longer shots to ground it in a way that we always know where the people are in relation to each other. That doesn't happen at the end of The Dark Knight.
Very well said. And it's very hard, too, because Nolan gives us one of the most beautifully choreographed acts of violence earlier in the film.
Yeah.
That, you know, down the canyon by the Chicago Board of Trade there with the semi-truck flipping over. But you're absolutely right, which renders the ending a little bit cartoonish and sort of what is going on.
Right. And we do want to say right now, in terms of spoilers, I don't think we're going to give anything away here in this listener feedback segment unless you don't know anything at all about what happens to the Harvey Dent character and you don't want to know anything. Mm-hmm. But I think for the most part, that's common knowledge. That's maybe the most we're going to get into here. Let's go to this one from Barry Wheeler in Clover, South Carolina. Here's the reason I was so impressed with Heath Ledger's Joker. I believed him. I'm a comic book geek from way back, and I like this summer's crop of movies pretty well. But as a whole, they're all still comic book movies, and I don't really believe them. I don't believe in the Batman. I don't believe in Two-Face. I don't believe in Hellboy or Iron Man or any of those guys. But I completely bought the Joker. He didn't have any superpowers or super gadgets or fantastical abilities. He was just completely, utterly, joyously, insanely mean. That made him real for me, and for my money anyway, probably the scariest villain I've seen on screen.
I'm putting him up there, but I got to go with Hannibal Lecter and Rutger Hauer and Blade Runner too, you know? So He's not quite there. But you really like this performance. For all the reasons that he just stated.
Yeah, exactly. No, he said it very well. He said it better than I ever could, actually. The one thing I will say is I would still put, and I'm sorry to keep going back to No Country for Old Men, but I would put Anton Chigurh up there. And here's the difference for me between him and The Dark Knight that makes him even more terrifying. They're both about lawlessness and anarchy and chaos, and they thrive on that, the lack of rules. But Chigurh cannot be deterred from what he's doing.
Right.
You cannot reason with him in any way. He has a job to do. You are in his way. You will die. Simple as that. The Joker, you could come up with a way to get him not to kill you. You could be like, hey, but by not killing me, X, Y, and Z can happen. Or maybe I can give you this guy. And you could come up with a way to get the Joker off your track. but yeah. You're not going to get Shiger off.
You're absolutely right, because a lot of people actually equate Shiger with the Grim Reaper. Mm-hmm. Does he actually even exist?
Right.
I think he exists, but I do really believe that he is evil incarnate, and You're right. He cuts a much meaner swath than the Joker.
Yeah, Barry, though, said it very well. And a lot of love, of course, for Heath Ledger. We'll get into a little bit more of it here, but also this next one from Joshua. He wants to praise another character that completely slipped through the cracks, I think, during our review.
Writing in from Manchester, UK, after rushing to see The Dark Knight on its release in the UK, I was impressed by one of the performances above the others. Not Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker, although brilliant, but Gary Oldman's as Lieutenant James Gordon. Since his performance as Stansfield in Leon, I have never been able to watch a film starring Oldman without linking him to that character until now. A true feat considering how easily I could have linked the Joker's time bomb characteristics to Oldman's performance as Stansfield. His performance may not have been as flashy as Ledger's, but I was with him throughout the film.
I agree. I actually really like Gary Oldman as well, and I do feel bad that I'm not sure if I got to praise him at all during the review, but he was a character that I was really following And was really invested in throughout the whole movie, and Oldman really manages to find that line between playing a character, playing a comic book type of character, but also playing someone who's really grounded in reality.
Yeah, I think he really stands in for the audience. He's our foil here, and he is very, very good. I just didn't like his plot line, the thing with his son. I just didn't really buy that.
Okay, I can see that. And it's also worth pointing out that Joshua Lawrence there, he mentioned Stansfield from Leon the Professional. Other listeners wrote in and pointed out that Heath Ledger's Joker, very reminiscent of that psycho that Gary Oldman plays in Leon, and I agree completely. Matt in Janesville, Wisconsin writes in, "While I understand the complaints regarding the film's length, I'm not sure giving it the total downer ending Adam endorsed would have been the best move. The film had already devoted so much time to Harvey Dent's character and had shown glimpses of how aggressive he could be. I totally bought his transition, and here is, I'll say it right now, the potential spoiler if you want to stop listening, into a full-fledged villain. There's the fact that doing the right thing as a DA involves dealing with these sort of impossible-to-win situations, and that has become maddeningly frustrating. All of his attempts to do right have resulted in nothing but harm, so to me, his rage was understandable. Since The Dark Knight dealt so much with duality, / dichotomy, / twos, the opposites of Batman and the Joker, the conflict within Dent, etc., I'm not sure if I want to sit through a third Batman movie that has Dent as the focus again, dealing with more moral uncertainty and more scenes of Batman trying to talk him down."
I could have. I really would have. Yeah. I would have liked to have seen Dent be the focal point of the next film, because I really did. I felt like Aaron Eckhart is so brilliant in that role. And again, I talked about this in a review. What I was able to latch onto, because there is so much plot in this movie, was that love triangle. And that's what's propelling Aaron Eckhart here. And he is the perfect opposite of Batman in the mirror. And I was totally, totally into it. And it just feels tacked on.
Yeah, it did a little bit to me. But our next listener here, Maddie, does have a really nice argument for why it had to play out the way it does, and so we definitely want to share it.
This is Josh Spiegel writing in from Glendale, Arizona. Part of the reason I'm glad the Harvey Dent story is there is because had the movie ended at the 145 mark, which you suggested, Adam, The new movie would be in an awful place, since Heath Ledger's Joker would be so vital to the story. Sure, his disappearance could be explained away, but I doubt even Nolan could fashion a story that wouldn't seem faked. More than anything else, the reason I had no issue with the Harvey Dent storyline is that I never questioned it. The main question for you was, exhilarated or exhausted? I was always exhilarated. I had liked but not loved Batman Begins, partly because it never got out of the origin phase. Though that story was interesting, I was never swept away. This movie not only has no origins for any character, even Dent, but is full throttle, and I loved that choice. Though it's true that the high point of the film is the scene culminating with an 18-wheeler flipping over, I wanted it to keep going, even during the climax.
Well, I might take a little bit of issue with him saying that there's no origin story even for Dent, because it's true that Harvey Dent, the DA, comes out of nowhere. Obviously, we do see the origin of what he becomes a little bit later, and I'm not sure there's much of an origin story. We need to see him in law school. That wouldn't necessarily make sense.
You know, I actually buy it. I actually kind of got the fact that this guy's a flawed guy. He's not completely all there.
Right.
They just sort of hint at it. So you're right. I didn't need an origin story.
Well, no, and this is something I mentioned to another listener, Jolene, who wrote in. She's like, did you miss this, Adam, and this that showed that he had this dark side? All of those actually... those are examples for me of moments where he just proved his integrity. He always still did the right thing in the end. So then to see him finally take that leap to the dark side that he does, I didn't quite buy it. I'm glad Josh was exhilarated by it throughout the whole movie. And Josh touches on something other listeners mentioned, which is that if you did end it at the hour 45 mark with the Joker just sort of running amok, then... you know, that storyline seems completely unresolved. You've basically got the Joker still running amok in the third film, and what are we going to do with him? Obviously, you can't recast him.
Right.
And you also can't have Heath Ledger play the role. So what are you going to do? Honestly, though, I still think Nolan probably could have ended the film there, and I'm not sure I needed the Joker storyline to resolve. It was enough for me, actually, and good for me to know that maybe he's still out there running amok.
Yes, perhaps. Perhaps. I'm just going to throw this out there. Maybe we don't need another Batman film.
I don't know about that, Maddie. Those are fighting words, though. I think our last emailer here, Heather Knoll in Edmonton, Alberta, would agree with you. Is it better for a film to be consistently mediocre or take a nosedive from near brilliance two-thirds of the way in? That's the question I've been asking since I walked out of my Wednesday night sneak preview of The Dark Knight, surrounded by fanboys looking for my declaration of unconditional love. Sorry, no can do. Maybe if the film had ended 40 minutes earlier. Certainly The Dark Knight has improved on the series by leaps and bounds. I wasn't really impressed with Batman Begins, but I think even hardcore fans will have trouble going back and sitting through some of its big, confusing action scenes. Like you, Adam, I would have walked out exhilarated had the film ended with the big reveal of Two-Face, but it just keeps going, and after 8 or so action sequences, plus a bunch of spoiler stuff Heather mentions, nothing you show me after is going to compare. Quit while you're ahead. Now, no matter how great the rest of it was, I'm stuck with this nagging feeling of let down. Okay, I'm going to quit while I'm ahead. I've learned there is one thing you don't do in a post-Dark Knight world, and that's criticize The Dark Knight.
What are you talking about? We do it here every week.
We did, though we did really like the movie. I'm going to hedge again one more time, Maddie. But also, we did get so many emails on this, more than we've ever received for any film. A lot of people, I'm kind of surprised, did really agree with us that, you know, it wasn't this perfect film, that some of the fourth act stuff didn't work as well as we would have liked in that transformation and whatnot. But of course, the vast majority of feedback were people who really did like this movie or love it. So we want to make sure, of course, that that is clear. And we appreciate all the great feedback. That officially is going to close out our talk of The Dark Knight, at least until we get into the end of the year stuff. I'm sure the Joker will rear his ugly head again. If you've got any feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Time for another quick break. Up next, Massacre Theater. And it's a very difficult job. And the only way to get through it is we all work together as a team. And that means you do everything I say.
Sounds a bit like one of our production meetings.
Our classic heist marathon returns with Michael Caine in The Italian Job. Stay with us.
Curse the day, I'm cursing all the way and back again. Into town to meet my maker, 4 feet tall.
We want to take a moment to announce the winners of our Recast Reservoir Dogs contest. You can check out all the entries at filmgaming.spout.com. Maddie, we have two winners, and the first prize winner is
Carl42.
I love this list.
This is phenomenal. I'm sorry. This takes the cake.
Yeah.
Peter Boyle as Mr. White, Al Pacino as Mr. Orange, Bobby De Niro as Mr. Blonde, Jimmy Caan as Nice Guy Eddie, Joe Pesci as Mr. Pink, Burgess Meredith as Joe Cabot.
Why not?
Martin Scorsese, of course.
Of course.
Of course, as Mr. Brown. Richard Farnsworth as Mr. Blue, another inspired pick. Harvey Keitel as the Holdaway. And Stephen Prince, the gun salesman in Taxi Driver, as the young cop who gets his ear cut off. And of course, Wolfman Jack is K. Billy DJ.
Yeah, it's good stuff. Carl42 wrote in. He turned in a meticulously crafted tale about a Martin Scorsese-created version of Reservoir Dogs from 1978. And Spout notes that his story wasn't necessary to win first place, but it was choices like Wolfman Jack as the K. Billy DJ and Burgess Meredith as Joe Cabot that earned him the win. His story is a lot of fun. And here's actually an excerpt, and we should read this. The most memorable scene is De Niro carving the ear off of Stephen Prince to the song Yakety Yak, while saying the words, "Don't talk back," into the man's amputated ear as the officer screams. Then out comes the gasoline to the tune, "Great Balls of Fire." You can read this whole story,
wow,
if you dare.
Wow.
On page 3 of the discussion at filmgaming.spout.com. Carl42 may have too much time on his hands, but now he can use that time to read the new graphic novel adaptation of M, the Fritz Lang film. Email feedback@filmspotting.net to claim your prize. And we also have a second place winner.
Iren, I-R-E-N, Reservoir Dogs becomes Busted Plans, I believe a Western
from
1955. You've got Sterling Hayden as Mr. White, Richard Boone as Mr. Orange, Lee Marvin, Mr. Blonde, Robert Mitchum, Nice Guy Eddie, Timothy Carey as Mr. Pink, Jackie Gleason as Joe Cabot, Charles Bronson as Mr. Brown, Vincent Price as Mr. Blue, I like that one, Jack Webb as the young cop who gets his ear cut off, Orson Welles. Orson Welles, Adam.
Okay.
As K. Billy DJ. And the ear-chopping tune is Lost Highway by Hank Williams.
Spout's comments on this one. I love the idea of Lee Marvin playing Mr. Blonde. He would reference himself in the movie when his character says to Mr. White, I bet you're a big Lee Marvin fan. That moment would be as shocking as getting a pot of coffee thrown in your face.
Oh, I love
and
it.
Having Orson Welles play the K-Billy DJ is brilliant, giving the voice that brought us War of the Worlds another opportunity to freak out the nation. He would introduce a Hank Williams tune as Lee Marvin removes the ear of Jack Webb, who played Joe Friday on Dragnet. Perfect. Congratulations, Iren. You get that $10 gift certificate to the Spout store and a t-shirt.
And what's that website again? Because really, we do encourage people to go over there. Spout has been such a great supporter of this show. And, you know, it just takes a moment of your time. Click on over there. You're helping us out. You're helping them out. And it, as you can see, it's a lot of fun.
Inspired stuff from our wonderful, smart, creative listeners. Again, you can read it all and participate at filmgaming.spout.com.
Shake it off, I can't shake it. All these feelings in my head. I want silence, no more anger.
I love to read. I enjoy books.
Those are the same thing. Why have you been going through my trash? I'll come back to that. I didn't know he was going to send another cook.
I just guessed.
Just guessed.
The first one seemed too easy.
This can no longer be ignored. What is that you're drinking?
It's an Aqua Velva. We wouldn't make fun of it if you tried it.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie. I'm Maddie. That's Adam. It's time now for Massacre Theater, wherein Adam and I can come together once again as brethren and massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a beloved DVD of your choice. Now, last week we massacred the scene you just heard between Robert Downey Jr. and the great Jake Gyllenhaal from David Fincher's Zodiac. Both you, Adam, and our guest Scott Tobias had it as your number one movie of the year so far last July, and of course, Robert Downey Jr. was in one of this year's most popular films, The Iron Man.
Yes, he was, but wait, Maddie, there's more. Joseph Buza wrote in noting that Jake's had some man love with the Joker, and I quote, and Harris Savides, the DP on Zodiac, has worked extensively with Gus Van Sant. His movie Paranoid Park, of course, appeared on all three of our top five lists last week. Jeff Peterson in Ramona, California wrote in saying that Jake played the lifeless Robert Graysmith in Zodiac, and his sister Maggie played Rachel Dawes in The Dark Knight. Finally, Cecilia Rogers in Park Slope, Brooklyn pointed out that the scene, quote, definitely connects with the serial killer issues of this Dark Knight podcast. Of course, we intended every single one of those connections, and frankly, I'm a little disappointed more people didn't catch the Harris Savides parallel.
Well, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pull out this week's winner.
The winner is Se-Young Kang from UCSB.
Oh, man. Have you ever seen UCSB's campus?
I have not.
Oh, it's right there
Santa
on the beach.
Barbara?
You wouldn't
nice.
Want to go anywhere else.
Well, congratulations to Se-Young Kang. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and I hope I said your name right or close, and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
On to this week's scene. It does tie in with our top five, as we usually do here on Massacre Theater. Of course, our top five swan songs coming up. And Maddie, I had a scene all picked out. You decided to go with an audible and picked, basically, a slam dunk easy scene here. That's what I'm saying.
Fine.
This is obvious.
Fine, you've thrown down the gauntlet.
I have.
All right.
And we know how our listeners respond when we do that. So let's go ahead and get it started. I'm going to give you the action, and I will note that, once again, I'm playing the female part. And action.
I've been thinking about us, too. About our people living like pigs in good rich land laying fallow. Or maybe one guy with 1,000,000 acres and 100,000 farmers starving. And I've been wondering if all our folks got together and yelled.
Oh, they drag you out and cut you down just like they done to Blank.
They drag me anyway. Sooner or later they get me for one thing if not another. Until then...
Blank, you're not aiming to kill nobody.
No, Mom, not that. That ain't it. It's just, well, as long as I'm an outlaw anyways, maybe I can do something. Maybe I can just find out something, just scrounge around and maybe find out what it is that's wrong and see if there ain't something that can't be done about it. I ain't got it thought all too clear, Ma. I can't. I don't know enough.
How am I going to know about you, Blank? Why, they could kill you and I never know. They could hurt you. How am I going to know?
And scene. You know what my hope is?
What's your hope?
My hope is we have young aspiring filmmakers that actually listen to the show. I can't believe it. But my hope is one day that they make a film and they write two parts for us. We can be the bumbling, you know, hitmen. That would be great roles for us. But you would have to do it in that voice.
In that voice? As the mother character?
Yes.
I love it. I'll take it. Whatever role you want me for. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name, location, and the movie's title to feedback at filmspotting.net. You have until Wednesday, July 30th.
Man, you should sell Betty Crocker. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit us at www.filmspotting.net.
What is the Italian job?
A seat in chaos. A smashing grab raid and $4 million.
$4 million? I think we can take that over, Roger. Go! You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off!
I don't know if you know this, Adam, but Hollywood has a tendency to remake movies.
I've noticed.
Yes. And people, they tend to get understandably upset when one of their favorite films is up for renewal.
Have you ever seen one of your favorite films be renewed?
And especially angry if Keanu Reeves is said to be interested in some way in the project. I bring this up because The Italian Job is a 1968 film from Oakhurst Productions and Paramount, and it is a beloved, much beloved British caper film, especially by the Brits.
Yes.
It stars Michael Caine, who leads a crack team or a not-so-crack team with the notion of stealing gold bars from an armored truck by causing a traffic jam in the streets of Turin and escaping with the loot in three Mini Coopers. Adam, my question is simple for you. You're the head of Paramount.
Mm-hmm.
It's 2003. Someone comes to you with a script and says, hey, I got an idea. I want to remake The Italian Job. Do you chuck the new treatment in the trash, or do you say, yeah, I can see how that movie could be improved?
Well, I do like to see myself as a modern-day Robert Evans, so that's fine. I'll go with your little hypothetical situation here, Maddie. You know, why not? I would probably go for it, and not because the movie isn't good, because I think The Italian Job is a fine movie. I actually did enjoy this caper film, though with some reservations that I'm sure we'll get into. But yeah, I didn't love it so much that I can be like, oh my, this is hallowed ground,
this
don't touch
sacrosanct.
It. Yeah. That all said, I haven't seen the new version of The Italian Job. I'm not any more interested in seeing it after seeing the original version. This one, for me, the thing about it, and this is both a praise and maybe a criticism, is it's pure entertainment. That's all it is. And actually, Andrew Fleming, who directed the movie Hamlet 2, we're going to talk about it next week on the show. I was prepping for my interview with Steve Coogan, and he had a line in there talking about Hamlet 2 that perfectly sums up The Italian Job. He says, and I quote, "It is about being emotionally on board. The death knell of a comedy is, even if it's funny, if you're an hour into it and suddenly you realize you have no emotional involvement and it's just about laughs." Well, it doesn't take you that long to realize with The Italian Job that there's no emotional involvement.
No.
And it's just great action scenes and Michael Caine acting cool. And that is more than enough to make it fun and worth watching, without a doubt. But there really isn't anything more there to grab onto at all. In terms of, there's no romance angle really with a love story. We don't get to know any of the guys or even need to keep track of them, know who they are from one another, much less care about whether or not they make it through the heist or not, like we do in a movie such as The Lavender Hill Mob. And even Michael Caine doesn't have much personality. The most this film has going for it, if you're looking for anything deeper, is that if you want to get into that whole kind of jingoistic Go England aspect of the film,
yes,
it's definitely there. The red, white, and blue Mini Coopers. Bridger gets applauded in the jail when, you know, the heist is pulled off and the England chants rain down. And there's that whole soccer match angle going on. But other than that, this movie is kind of about England asserting its power in a really uncertain time. That's kind of interesting if you want to read it that way. But really, it's just pure fun. And that's all there is to it.
Yeah, you basically read my notes here. I was surprised how silly this film was. I mean, it's goofier than The Lavender Hill Mob, which styles itself as a comedy. You've got Benny Hill in a Mo Howard wig. I repeat, Benny Hill in a Mo Howard wig. You've got Noel Blyspirit Coward engaged in toilet humor.
And I like
literal toilet humor. It was cute. And then you've got that Quincy Jones pen song, which I cannot get out of my head.
Self-preservation society with Michael Caine singing.
Yeah, exactly. It's just all very, very, very silly. And you're right. Michael Caine, he looks cool and he looks very, very pretty, but I don't even really know what he is. I don't really know who he is. And you didn't connect with any of his merry men.
No.
They're not given any backstory at all, and they're just all pretty bland. I mean, the killing doesn't give us any backstory of his hoods, but I seem to know who they were.
Right.
These guys here on Kane's team, all they seemed good for was spouting off really bad one-liners in the heat of the moment,
yeah.
You know, during the chase scene. But I did like the chase scene.
Well, the chase scene
is a lot
yeah,
of fun.
It's fantastic. It's the big reason to see this film. But you're right. It is the swinging 60s. It's about these people acting cool, Michael Caine in great suits, driving a great car, and that's really all the deeper it is. And the car chases are great fun. They're well shot. They're well edited. And, you know, the line, of course, the classic line, you're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. It is a great line. But, you know, there aren't a whole lot more like it. Michael Caine in this movie is pretty droll. Even when they destroy his car that he loves so much, it's kind of cool that he doesn't react at all to it. Like, doesn't sigh, doesn't make an expression, doesn't say anything. Of course, that shows his coolness that he doesn't react, but there's a stoicism about Caine throughout the whole film and about the movie in general that I think it really does keep you from getting too caught up in it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you're talking about the moment where the mafia is on the hillside,
yeah.
And they throw... Okay, first of all, if we don't know...
The dance moves, the synchronized dance moves?
If we don't know anything about Michael Caine as his team, we know even less about these bad guys. Basically, they stand on the hillside with these guns, and it's like something... It struck me as something like out of The Prisoner, that trippy TV show from the 60s. And why? You know Michael Caine is there to rip you off. Why not kill him when you have the chance?
Right.
You killed the guy that set this whole thing in motion. You know Michael Caine is going to try and rob you tomorrow. Why not take some measures? You've got him right here. Hey, just kill him. Or maybe don't go through the routine as you always would.
Exactly. No, and what happens with the professor character, right? Professor Peach or whatever.
Benny Hill.
He seems to go to jail or something, but then it just doesn't, we don't see him at all.
Right.
And really his character is completely wasted in the movie and really isn't funny. I do have to ask, I think we have to close here by asking though, what you thought of the literal cliffhanger ending. I don't want to get too much more into it, but you can't talk about the Italian Job without talking about the ending of the film. What did you think?
All I can say is I liked it.
Yeah.
It was just sort of a surreal moment, and I'm thinking, how are they going to end this film?
Of course.
Exactly are they ending this film? Okay. All right. That's an interesting proposal.
It was a surprise.
I'll go with that.
Yeah, sure. I went with it too, but I was really looking forward to finally seeing a movie in this heist marathon where the criminals actually pulled it off.
Now, come on. They might get away.
Yes, they might get away, but they didn't go for it all the way, and I really can't appreciate that note they left us on. But what I don't like about it is you talk about the silliness and kind of the plot. I didn't really buy that Michael Caine would let it happen, that he would let everything unfold the way he did. He's so meticulous in how he's planned this. For him to get careless at the end before the heist was actually finished, I know that they were anticipating a sequel, and that's why they left it open-ended. Maybe that's never a good thing when you're trying to end a film, though, because things do kind of end in a wishy-washy way. But don't you think that Michael Caine, everything's gone exactly how he planned it for the most part, and he's hyper-serious. Again, he's very stoic. To all of a sudden at the end think that he's in the clear and to let the driver do what happens, I didn't completely go for it.
I didn't find him as meticulous as you did. I actually felt when they actually make the grab on the armored truck, it reminded me of Rafifi. It's very, very brutish. It's very, very violent for a moment there.
Sure.
It's really a smash grab. And throughout, I just felt sort of a mishmash. And I got to disagree a little bit. I felt that Michael Caine was cool. I think he thought he knew what was going on the entire time, but I wasn't completely with him the entire time.
I don't know. Something about him letting loose there too early didn't completely work for me. But you know what? I did like the movie.
I'm giving it three stars.
I'm saying you should see it for those great action sequences. But in terms of maybe a Rafifi or even the Lavender Hill Mob, where you had great characters that you really were invested in, I don't think the Italian Job gives you that as much. But next week on the show, we will get into Jean-Pierre Melville's Le Cercle Rouge. We have two more films left in this heist movies marathon, and then we're going to get on to our Angry Young Man marathon. It kicks off in September, so you can get started on that now if you want, and you can check out the full lineup on our marathons page. More British cinema.
I cannot wait. All right, time for one last quick break. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Our top five swan songs are up next.
I see you go with Shakespeare instead of Zeppelin then.
That's how I roll. Stay with us.
Left in the hands of desperate fortune. My father rides the rails away from me.
Time now to take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. Again, Light Trading. on the DVD front, but The Counterfeiters is coming out, a movie, Maddie, you saw, a movie I did not see. Actually, the foreign language
Oscar
best
Award
Oscar winner.
Winner,
yeah, from last year. That is out now. It includes an audio commentary with the director, Stefan Ruzowitzki, and a featurette along with interviews and other special features. So, Maddie, is it one that I and our listeners should check out?
No, I really, yes, I think you should check it out, but I was really not that drawn into it. For a movie about the Holocaust that takes place in a concentration camp, I just did not find those scenes all that evocative.
Okay, well, a movie I do think you find evocative, The Grapes of Wrath, a new edition of that film, is out now on DVD, and that wraps up DVDs. Let's get to donations.
Yeah, we want to thank everyone who surfed their way over to filmspotting.net this past week and threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. As always, we are truly, truly humbled by each and every donation. It goes such a long way in keeping us doing what we're doing. That is not just boilerplate language. We really are grateful. So thank you to a couple Silver Club donors. Sean from Chicago. I know Sean is a longtime listener. He
Great
writes
feedback.
In every week.
Good stuff.
And Kimberly from Arvada, Colorado. I know Kimberly has given before as well.
Yeah, and also a Massacre Theater winner, and now she gives us back money that offsets the fact that she won a prize. That's
right.
Okay. We'll
That's
take it.
Silly. That's yeah. silly. You don't need to do that. Also want to thank Michael from Castle Gregory, Kerry, Ireland. I have to say, thank you, internets. I looked up Castle Gregory, according to the internets, which has lied to me before, 205 people.
Really?
And if you were to think of an ideal Irish fishing town, Castle Gregory would be it.
I want to be there. Let's
and
go.
Let's head across the Irish Sea to Headington, Oxford, England, home of Emma, another donor. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We're so big in Oxfordshire. I think Adam and I, we could probably run for council there.
We could, and I'm just looking ahead at the next name on our list, and I didn't even realize how funny this is until right now.
Rick from
Springfield,
Jesse's Virginia. Girl. I love it, Jesse's girl. And Springfield, Virginia, of course. What is Virginia for?
Lovers.
There you go. And Peter from Münster, Germany. Now, unfortunately, I need to know. You know me. I'm a facts and figures guy, and I love geography. I love history. All my historical knowledge of cities in Germany, unfortunately, is that we bombed them. And I think Münster was one of those old fortress cities that we bombed the hell out of.
Well, Peter, let us know.
Exactly. Write in. Tell me what's great about your city. And then Jonathan, I know Jonathan's a longtime listener and a previous donor from Boulder, Colorado.
Yes, he is a very diligent listener and donor. We do appreciate it from everyone.
And remember that for every $10 you donate, your name is entered into that old weathered film spotting hat. At the end of the month, we pick a name and you get to pick a film for us to review on an upcoming edition of Film Spotting After Hours. Also, we started this new trend. You might win a t-shirt
you
or two.
You just might.
If you're feeling lucky. If you'd like to donate, go to filmspotting.net and click on the donation tab at the top of the page.
Yeah, we just posted our latest After Hours podcast this past Tuesday. Neil from Oxford, Oxfordshire is our next listener's choice winner. We haven't heard from him yet. We want to know what movie we're going to be talking about, and we did share three other prizes as well. And speaking of prizes, Maddie, we do have to announce our next contest going on now at filmgaming.spout.com. We're asking you to cast Batman 3. Maddie, we talked about this a little bit during our feedback segment. The unfortunate passing of Heath Ledger made The Dark Knight an even bigger cliffhanger than it was meant to be. If the Joker story isn't resolved, it'll be like if Han Solo had never been freed from carbonite. On the other hand, maybe there's another villain worthy of taking the spotlight after the Joker's turn in The Dark Knight. We want you to pick a villain and an actor to play him. Write a brief letter to Christopher Nolan convincing him your villain is worthy of being the Dark Knight's adversary in Batman 3. And Spout notes that some people are saying Johnny Depp would make a great Riddler, but is the Riddler a great villain? A good question. So choose a villain and an actor, and the most exciting pair wins. The hardworking publicists at Spout.com will try their darndest to get the winning choices in front of Christopher Nolan. No guarantees, but it's worth a shot. So you can enter now at filmgaming.spout.com. You got an idea, Maddie?
What about Destro?
Destro.
Destro?
I'm drawing a blank.
Albert Finney is Destro?
Albert Finney.
Skeletor?
Is Albert Finney still alive?
Otherwise, he would have made my list.
Yeah, exactly. What movie was he in? But you can enter now, and the first prize winner is going to receive the graphic novel adaptation of M by John J. Muth.
David Hyde Pierce as the Clock King.
Okay. You're also going to get some Film Spotting swag, and a second prize winner will get a $10 Spout gift certificate and a t-shirt. What could be better than that? Enter now, filmgaming.spout.com. You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and it's top five time here on the show. We're giving you our top five swan songs, final performances by actors or actresses. Actually, a list inspired by Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight, though yes, we know he still has Terry Gilliam's The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus coming out. But Maddie, how did you do with this list? What's your number five?
Well, you know, it's one of those things where you could actually plug in any one of the great actors in my honorable mention into my top five.
Sure.
There were a lot here, but I hate to say it, but my list kind of reflects our nation's voting history for the past 200 years. It's a lot of white guys.
Me too.
All right.
Sadly.
Well, yeah. My number five is James Dean from Giant, my sister's favorite movie growing up. I've been treated to Mr. Dean's performance in this film countless, countless time, and I think he is terrific. You know, there's footage out there of Marlon Brando reading for Rebel Without a Cause. He must have been seriously considered for the role because he's doing the whole scene off book in costume. Watching Marlon mumble his way through that performance only serves to reinforce how great James Dean really, really was. And I like his turn in Giant because it's different. He's not playing the rebel. He actually goes through an age transformation. It's a great role.
Well, it's a great pick and actually a perfect setup for my preface to my top five list, because it would probably be more interesting, actually, instead of hearing my list, to hear my top five list of film spotting regrets. This is a film spotting confession list here. I'm going to tell you the movies that could have been on this list, that should have been considered, that unfortunately I haven't seen. But there is a happy ending here to all of them. First of all, James Dean in Giant. I've seen East of Eden. I've seen Rebel Without a Cause. I have not seen Giant. Fortunately, though, it was on AMC this week, or actually maybe HDNet Movies. I TiVo'd it. I have it at home. I promise to watch it this week. Also, John Wayne and the Shootist. Not going to make my list. I haven't seen it, but it's on AMC next week. Already got the DVR set. And then, of course, Clark Gable and Marilyn Monroe in The Misfits. I went out and rented it. Just haven't fitted in yet.
Montgomery Clift, too.
And Montgomery Clift in that movie as well. So I want to lay those out right now and apologize, but obviously I plan to get to all of them very soon. And we should note that this list was actually suggested by a listener here in Chicago, Sandra Weiss. May have had a few other listeners mention it as well. But I'm going to dive right in with my number five, and it is Jason Robards in the film Magnolia, P.T. Anderson's movie.
Oh, interesting pick.
Yeah, he was Robards, it turns out, born in Chicago. Didn't know that. In 1922, he died in 2000. Magnolia had just come out the year before in 1999. He did appear in one TV role after that, but this was his last film. And he really is great as Earl Partridge in that movie, sick on his deathbed. There's some pretty heavy scenes between him and P.S. Hoffman, and I know with Cruz as well as his son, but I have to confess, I haven't seen the movie in a long time, and I can't really remember if the scenes with Cruz are more one-sided in Cruz's favor, or if there is a lot of talking. I seem to think that he is resting a lot or sleeping during those scenes. I could be wrong, but he is great in that film. He, of course, is great in Once Upon a Time in the West, too, as Cheyenne. His iconic role is always going to be
Ben Bradley.
Ben Bradley, of course, in All the President's Men. And I'm going to cheat a little bit here, and just because I love it so much, it's in the pantheon, and I'm picking him for Magnolia, but I want to use this as a chance to play my favorite scene with Jason Robards as Ben Bradley.
You guys are probably pretty tired, right? Well, you should be. Go on home. Get a nice hot bath. Rest up 15 minutes. Then get your asses back in gear. We're under a lot of pressure, you know, and you put us there. Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution, freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country. Not that any of that matters. But if you guys fuck up again, I'm going to get mad.
Doesn't get any better than that in terms of the writing and the delivery there. Jason Robards, my number five.
All right, well, my number four, I want to thank you, Film Spotting Sci-Fi Marathon. This is a recent discovery for me, Eddie G. Robinson. I, of course, remember him as the snarling gangster in Key Largo, and before that, he's great in Little Caesar. But he is the pathos of Soylent Green. Mm-hmm. He really is. And the last scene he ever filmed was the euthanasia scene in Soylent Green. How trippy is that?
Yeah, it is trippy. A great pick. Obviously, we were both big fans of that performance. My number four, there's going to be two overlaps here with a list we did a while back, Maddie. Our top five senior citizen performances. I think we said actors over 60 or maybe 65 for that list, but I got to have Richard Farnsworth on here for The Straight Story. Also died in 2000, like Robards, plays Alvin Straight. This movie came out in 1999, the David Lynch film. I, of course, think of him first as Red from The Natural, the assistant coach there, along with Wilford Brimley, but he's just heartbreaking as Alvin Straight driving from Iowa, based on a true story, of course, to Wisconsin to see his estranged brother one last time. And he had bone cancer. He knew it was terminal. He was dying, you know, during the shoot. He was miserable and in a lot of pain. And he actually did end up taking his own life not too long after that. But really a great performance. One I don't think he got nominated for an Oscar for, even though there was a lot of buzz about him maybe getting one. I think he certainly was deserving of it, though he did win a Best Supporting Actor Oscar earlier in his career. I want to say I'm right on that. So Richard Farnsworth, my number four.
Well, my number three, I am going with Heath Ledger in The Dark Knight.
Oh, really?
And the reason I'm including him is because this was the last film that he wrapped. And also, I'd like to praise him just a little bit further. I think it really is his best performance, and it is stunning. And I've always thought he was good. I loved him in 10 Things I Hate About You. I liked him in The Patriot. I loved him in A Knight's Tale. He always took chances, and I actually don't think his work in Brokeback or I'm Not There are his best stuff, but I applaud his bravery. And I think this really truly is a great, great loss to the acting community because he really did bring so much to every role.
Well, I know many listeners out there agree with you, and I would have considered him for this top five, definitely. I did leave him off because there is that Gilliam film, though. You're right. We don't really know what they're going to do with that footage yet. And I want to name one other actor as well who I had to leave off because of this Heath Ledger rule, but we all sort of think of it because of the timing as his last performance, Ulrich Mühe from The Lives of Others. Brilliant, brilliant performance from just a couple years ago, 07, I want to say, actually. And he's so great in it, but there was other stuff he had in the can, and he's been in a few other things after his death. But my number three, got to give it to Spencer Tracy in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It's a movie that I don't think is as progressive as some may argue or want it to be, and I'm sure we're going to get into that in our next class next spring at the University of Chicago when we talk about the new Hollywood. We will be watching and discussing that film. But he died in 1967, the same year this movie came out, actually 17 days after they wrapped shooting on it, and he was very sick. And the story goes anyway that, you know, he sits down a lot in the movie if you watch because he was so sick, but he's just great as Matt Drayton, and he still has that chemistry with Hepburn.
Unbelievable.
A great chemistry watching them together. He's another actor, I know this is a line you like a lot, who I don't think ever told a lie on screen.
Never told a lie on screen in his life, and he's my number two.
Ah.
And actually, if I had to make a top five Spencer Tracy, I mean, it's really, really hard because you've got Boys Town, you've got Judgment at Nuremberg, but I think he is really, really good here in this great film. And you sort of touched on all my points. Did you know he went to, but did not graduate, from Ripon College in Wisconsin?
I did not.
Do you know who else went to, but did not graduate, from Ripon College in Wisconsin?
No, I do not.
Harrison Ford.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Interesting stuff there. We love the trivia here on Film Spotting.
Use that. Get yourself a beer.
Well, obviously a great pick. My number two, this is my overlap with my previous senior citizens list as well. I have to go with Victor Sjostrom from Wild Strawberries.
Was that his last film?
That was his last film.
Oh, darn you, Kempinar.
I know. I looked it up just hoping on a whim that I was right, and it turns out I was. He was actually a very popular longtime actor, screenwriter, and director in Sweden, but this was his last effort as an actor, Bergman's 1957 classic Wild Strawberries. He ended up dying in 1960, but there's just so much humanity and vulnerability, despite the fact that he's a really cantankerous old man and is very bitter and difficult to deal with, but you really follow him the whole time, and he really just has this amazing journey, this old man looking back on his life with a lot of regret, and by the end comes to some kind of peace with it. And we come to that peace just by watching him, and mostly by watching his face. A lot of those great Bergman close-ups, not so much what he says, but just us watching him.
Well, you want a cantankerous old man. I'm going to give you my number one. Let's go ahead and hear a clip.
You want to know why I came back so fast? I got the end of our lane. I couldn't remember where the old town road was. One little way in the woods, there was nothing familiar, not one damn tree. Scared me half to death. That's why I came running back here to you. See your pretty face.
Another Kate Hepburn tie-in, of course, that was the legendary Henry Fonda in On Golden Pond as Katharine Hepburn's old poo. He brings such an elegant combination of grace and dignity to this role, and which he brought to basically every single role. And it could have easily been played strictly one note. Of course, he doesn't allow for that. Watching that interplay with Hepburn and then combine the fact that he's acting alongside his daughter, man, get out the pledge. Every time I watch this film, it gets really, really damn dusty.
And I think actually maybe during that senior citizen performances list that came out that I had not seen On Golden Pond, and I still have not watched it. So the whole list is just terrible. I can't believe we even did this week, unfortunately, because it just makes me look terrible. My number one, I'm actually really shocked that he did not make your top five, Maddie, because you find ways to praise him every week, much deserved, but it is John Cazale from The Deer Hunter.
Holy shit, you know what that is? Those are sun dogs. What does it mean?
It means a blessing on the hunter sent by the great wolf to his children.
What are you talking about?
No, it's an old Indian thing.
You're full of shit.
Stanley, would I shit you about something like that?
You know, Mike, there's times when nobody but a doctor can understand you.
And that's an omen, you know that?
John Cazale there in that scene with Robert De Niro from The Deer Hunter. And it is true that his last performance was probably not his best, certainly not his meatiest, and maybe that is why you left him off. But you look at those movies, and you've mentioned it before. He died way too young at age 43. He appeared in 5 films. If you want to count The Godfather 3, it's 6, but I don't count The Godfather 3. As far as I'm concerned, it never happened. So you've got The Godfather 1, The Godfather 2, The Conversation, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Deer Hunter. 5 of my favorite films of all time. He's in all of them, and he's wonderful in all of them, and really was a big loss. One of that great gang with De Niro and those guys in the 70s. So I had to put him on here more as maybe a lifetime achievement in that short amount of time, even though his performance isn't as big as Sjostrom from Wild Strawberries or Spencer Tracy or Farnsworth. I wanted to praise him, so he's my number one.
Well, I praise him all the time. I mean, John Cazale is one of the reasons I'm an actor. It's one of his watching his performances, especially in Dog Day Afternoon, were one of the reasons that I wanted to become an actor. And you're absolutely right. I don't think it's his best role. He's great, but I just couldn't quite get him in there amidst Tracy and Fonda. But he is on my honorable mention, as is Clark Gable from The Misfits, Burgess Meredith from Grumpy Old Men, Lillian Gish in The Whales of August, and Jackie Gleason, Nothing in Common, and Lee Strasberg from Going in Style.
Oh, I haven't seen that one, but I, of course, have Edward G. Robinson from Soylent Green in my honorable mentions, and also Sidney Pollack in Michael Clayton. I think he's really good playing that Sidney Pollack kind of role. And Nothing in Common, that's actually a really good pick of Jackie Gleason, because I loved that movie when I was a kid. And if I haven't said this before on the show, I'll say it now. That movie is part of the reason why I live in Chicago. Growing up in Iowa, I watched that movie, Nothing in Common. I saw Tom Hanks as this ad exec guy living in Chicago.
Oh, that scene where they're doing the pitch?
Yeah, exactly.
So cool.
Yeah, a lot of great scenes there. And the city is used really well in that film. And I said, I want to live and work in Chicago someday. Of course, I also thought I wanted to go into advertising. And here I am talking about movies instead of coming up with creative advertising pitches.
Slumming it with me.
Yes.
All right. Well, those are our top 5 swan songs. Please send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Opening wide this weekend, The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor, and Swing Vote with Kevin Costner. I know, Maddie, you have a beef with this film, don't you?
I'm not going to see it.
They tried to trick me.
They tried to trick me with their advertising. They tried to get me to think that it was a Kevin Costner baseball film, which of course I would go see.
Right.
But I'm not going to see him in anything else.
Plus, expanding to more screens this week, Baghead, the lo-fi do-it-yourself horror movie that I am curious about, and Brideshead Revisited. Two pretty polar opposites there. Next week, we're going to review David Gordon Green's Pineapple Express. We're going to talk about Le Cercle Rouge and the Heist Marathon. The calendar page at filmspotting.net has finally been updated, so if you want to see what's coming up in August, go ahead and check it out at filmspotting.net. We are not set, though, on a top 5 tie-in with Pineapple Express yet. I know there are some great suggestions in our message boards. We're considering them. If you've got a good tie-in suggestion, send it to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Thanks, as always, to Candace for her invaluable assistance, and to our great listener volunteers, Frank and Angela. Thank you, thank you. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Steve Edwards and the whole gang at Chicago Public Radio, along with the great Joe Dassault. Thank you so much for your production help. And to C. Ray for this week's music. Learn more at craymusic.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I likes to play the women.
How do I know? You're like Catherine.
I was a little over the top.
I liked it. And you've never seen Gone with the Wind? My God.
Yeah, I know.
You're Vivian Leigh every time.
I would date Mitch Reinhold. I would go out with Mitch Reinhold.
He's handsome.
He's handsome and he's nice and sweet and he's not a prick.
I agree. I just didn't
You think he actually saw she's on camera. I want to be on camera.
Yep. Yeah.
No, it's crazy. It's
I
crazy.
I think so.
Okay, dude.
I think so.
Okay, dude. Michael Caine.
I'm Michael Caine. I don't know if you know this, Adam, but Hollywood has a tendency.
Wait, you got to start again. Just because they're. Are you doing that?
No.
Oh, okay. Damn.